Many years ago, a Christian publishing house released a book by a man called Norman Anderson entitled Issues of Life and Death. It's quite a slim book. I still have it on a shelf somewhere. And it has shortish chapters on various ethical issues, capital punishment for one, euthanasia for another, and so on. Hence the title, Issues of Life and Death. And the focus of that particular book is very specific. The issues it addresses are very narrow, which is fair enough. But speaking more broadly than that, issues of life and death are the big issues, aren't they? They are the issues that have always troubled and perplexed people down the centuries and always will. So death, after all, is the great inescapable reality. Somebody said it's the ultimate statistic that one out of one dies. And what are we to make of it? How are we to face it? And how can the fear of death be overcome? Not often a big issue for young people, I guess, who are generally too active, too busy with other things, until one of them dies suddenly in a motorbike accident or maybe from a drug overdose. And on that occasion, the crematorium is packed out for the funeral, and those same young faces are ashen and bewildered and utterly lost. Their friend was here, suddenly he isn't here. Where's he gone? What's it all about? Will it be me tomorrow? The fear of death for most people is never far below the surface. It is a big issue, but life presents issues as well, and no shortage of them. People often ask and wonder whether there's life after death. Somebody of melancholy temperament might be heard asking whether there's any life before death. Is there anything bigger to live for than the things which occupy time and energy and yet seem to leave us restless and dissatisfied and always wanting something more? C.S. Lewis, as always, has trenchant words to say along these lines. Most people, he says, if they had really learned to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want, and want acutely, something that cannot be had in this world. There are all sorts of things in this world that offer to give it to you, but they never quite keep their promise. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, and no learning can really satisfy. I'm not now speaking of what would be ordinarily called unsuccessful marriages or holidays or learned careers. I'm speaking of the best possible ones. There was something we grasped at in that first moment of longing which just fades away in the reality. I think, he says, everyone knows what I mean. The wife may be a good wife, the hotels and scenery may have been excellent, and chemistry may be a very interesting job, but something has evaded us. Well, Issues of Life and Death would be a very good title for John's Gospel chapter 6, and for the whole of John's Gospel, and I suppose of the whole New Testament, in fact of the whole Bible, but this chapter as much as any, and as ever, it would help me and you too, I think, if you are able to look at it with me, page 1075, if you've lost it in the Bible in the chairs. This chapter begins, as we saw last week, with Jesus' miraculous feeding of 5,000 people from a handful of loaves and fishes. And that miracle leads on to an extended discussion between Jesus and those who were there at the time. And although he has met their physical needs, his message is unashamedly spiritual. He speaks about human experience of hunger and thirst, but it is not physical hunger and thirst that he has in mind. He feeds the 5,000 in order to point to a deeper need, an inner hunger and emptiness, which he is uniquely able to meet. It was so then, it remains so today, and it will do so till the end of time. And verse 35, it's a famous one, where Jesus says to them, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst. Here in Jesus Christ himself, he says, is food for the inner person. And it's not high-class confectionery for the specialist. That's no use to hungry people. He is bread, the staple food that you and I need in order to make sense of life in this world. And he takes time here to explain how our experience of life can, in fact, be rich and fulfilling and satisfying, and how death needs held no fear for us when it comes, because eternal life is here for the asking. That sounds good, doesn't it? Sounds rather attractive, meaningful, rich, fulfilling life, and the prospect of life beyond the grave. Wouldn't everyone want to hear about that and to find it? Sounds great. And yet, as Jesus continued to speak of these things, we find that it doesn't go down at all well with his hearers. The trajectory through the chapter is downwards, right through to the end. At the beginning, people are intrigued and asking questions, wanting to know more. By the end, most of them have gone off in a huff, muttering, grumbling, and saying, we just can't take any more of this. Now, Jesus' hearers are referred to here just as the Jews, meaning the varied bunch of ordinary local people who were listening to him out by the Sea of Galilee initially and later at the synagogue in Capernaum. And their mutterings home in on two objections in particular to what they hear. And they have a contemporary ring. They are very similar to people's objections to Jesus today. The first muttering is in verse 41. And essentially it means this: who does he think he is? Verse 41, the Jews grumbled about him because he said, I am the bread that came down from heaven. They said, isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How does he now say, I have come down from heaven? Who does he think he is? They are right, of course, in saying that they know Jesus' father and mother, but they think that when they've said that, they've said it all, and they cannot handle the further claims that Jesus makes. He has already, in the previous chapter, spoken of himself as God the Son, uniquely related to God the Father, and he develops that in this dialogue. He speaks of himself as the one who has come down from heaven, his natural abode, to live life on earth. Now, as we have been reminded, we are less than 100 sleeps away from Christmas. This is how it's put at the moment. Less than 100. It's probably nearer 80 or 70 now. And on Christmas Eve, there will doubtless be the familiar broadcasts on radio and television of carols from King's Chapel in Cambridge, beginning with Once in Royal David's City, verse 2 of which begins, He came down to earth from heaven, who is God and Lord of all. And it sounds nice, and it looks pretty, and the camera pans across the robed choir with its older and younger members, and the candles flicker prettily, and the stained glass is nice. In fact, it's illuminated from outside with great arc lights. They don't tell you that. It's actually filmed in the dark. But to give the impression of the fading evening light, they start by beaming great arc lights outside on the stained glass window of King's Chapel, which gradually fade as the service continues. It's very effective. It's all very lovely and very sentimental and very Christmassy as people sip their mulled wine and enjoy it. But think for a moment what the words are actually saying. He came down to earth from heaven, who is God and Lord of all, including Lord of the people singing or pretending to. And the people in John 6 don't like being told this at all, that he is the bread who came down from heaven. And people today, when they actually understand what Jesus is really saying, may not like it either themselves. He cannot be explained in merely human terms. It is not enough to say we know his father and mother. He is the son of Joseph. And we today may wish to wrap him up in the cotton wool of Christmas sentimentality and bring him out once a year, but he is much too big for that. He has come down to draw people to himself in order that by coming to him, they may come to the knowledge of God, because he alone offers that access. Now, verse 46, he says, not that anyone, no one has seen the Father, except he who is from God himself, in other words, he has seen the Father. It's extraordinary how in these paragraphs, in fact, everywhere, Jesus talks so much about himself. It's a simple point, but it's a very important one. He talks endlessly about himself. I, me. And I don't know how you find it, but I find that people who talk endlessly about themselves are generally rather boring. A friend of mine, whose business involves marketing on a fairly major scale, tells me of how a little while ago he took a very well-known media celebrity out to lunch. He's a household name, not my friend, the celebrity is the household name. Took him out for business purposes, and it was quite a long lunch and a very good one. It had to be because of his guest. And he said this man spent the whole time talking about himself. It was very, very tedious. I don't know whether it really helped his business, but his abiding memory is of a man just talked on and on about himself, what he was doing, his achievements, and so on. Now, you and I probably think that to talk endlessly about yourself is rather bad manners, but Jesus talks quite unashamedly about himself. I this, me that, I. And it isn't remotely tedious. On the contrary, it is very wonderful, because he is so wonderful a person. And as the bread of life, which he says he is, I am the bread of life. He has things to offer us which can be found nowhere else. He who comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst. And in verse 45, everyone who has learned and heard from the Father comes to me. Do you see that at the end of verse 45, the second half? Everyone who has heard and learned from God the Father comes to me. In other words, the genuine seeker for reality will be satisfied with nothing less than Jesus himself. Material pursuits won't satisfy, nor will the pursuit of pleasure and happiness. It won't work to become a Buddhist or a Muslim or a Hindu. Yoga won't do the trick. And it won't be enough to say, as people increasingly do in our materialistic age against which they react, it won't be enough to say, well, I'm quite a spiritual person, actually, underneath. No, Jesus says that everyone who is serious in seeking God will come to him. It's an extraordinary thing to say. And no wonder they said, who does he think he is? They don't like it. And it may not be that popular today. So that's the first focus to their muttering. Who does he think he is? The second objection comes in verse 52, and this is really what utter nonsense he talks. Verse 52, the Jews then disputed among themselves, crossly is the point, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? Jesus has just said in the previous verse, I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. And they say, what utter nonsense. How can he give us his flesh to eat? He's a complete fruitcake. It's not just that it's nonsense. That might not matter in itself. If he wants to talk nonsense, they might say, well, that's up to him. But this isn't just ordinary nonsense. This is arrogant nonsense, because he goes on in verse 53 to say, truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I'll raise him up on the last day. But if you don't, you have no life in you at all. And he's saying once again here that he is not an optional extra. It's the same point as being the bread. He's not just there for those who happen to like that sort of thing. It's a very plain statement that he makes, that we have no real life in us if we are not linked experientially to Jesus. It's a very bold statement. It was never designed to make him popular. And many people today will say, well, it's fine if you want to be Christian. That's great. I'm genuinely happy for you. That's your choice. But don't expect me to be one. And certainly don't expect your Christian thinking and attitudes to have any particular place in wider society, in our national life, where in a secular age, you know, things have moved on and you'd better get used to it. But you see, Jesus will not leave open that option of his being an optional extra for those who happen to like that sort of thing. Unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. He doesn't leave that option open. No wonder they don't like it. What utter nonsense he's talking. What are we to make of this talk of flesh and blood? It is strange, and it actually sounds quite gruesome, doesn't it? Eating his flesh and drinking his blood. It sounds gruesome, and it is meant to sound gruesome, because it points to a gruesome reality. Sarah and I were lucky enough to spend 3 nights just recently down in a Cornish farmhouse, bed and breakfast. It's a lovely place to stay in the Cornish countryside. A lovely host, Jill and Blair, were couldn't have been kinder to us. And on the final morning, we were just packing the car, ready to go. Blair had gone off to deal with the farm. We were just about to set off, and the voice came from the track down to the farm buildings, "Giles, get Jill!" And I thought, what's going on? And he appeared around the corner, and he was streaming blood from his head. You see these things perhaps in some sort of unpleasant thriller or something. You know it's all just tomato ketchup, and you don't worry about it. But this was not tomato ketchup. He had slipped, cracked his head open on something, he didn't know what, and he was not a pretty sight. He'd got a big gash in the side of his head and covered in blood all the way down. No wonder he said, "Get Jill." And before very long, they rushed off to local casualty, and he needed 21 staples in his head without anaesthetic. So it was no small problem. Blood is not meant to pour out of us like that. Blood is meant to stay inside, safely behind the skin. And it only pours out when something has gone wrong. And at that point, flesh and blood become separate things instead of bound up together. And Jesus is talking here about violence, when flesh and blood will be separated. He's looking ahead to his own violent death, which no amount of stapling or stitching would cure. Verse 51 again, he says, "The bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh." Now he's spoken of himself as the bread of life, the basic food we all need, and he now tells us that the way in which that life-giving bread which he is becomes available to us is by his sacrificial death on a cross. And it cannot be made available to us without that. "The bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh." And he elaborates that truth in the sentences that follow. To believe in Jesus and to feed on his flesh and blood are really two ways of saying the same thing. In fact, if you compare verse 40 and verse 54, it's just worth doing that. Fortunately, in our Bible, they're on the same page. Just look up at verse 40. You see that it finishes with the statement, "I will raise him up on the last day." If you look down at verse 54, it says exactly the same, "I will raise him up on the last day." Who is this person who will be raised up in the last day? Well, on verse 40, it's described as the person who looks on Jesus and believes. In verse 54, he's the person who feeds on his flesh and drinks his blood. They are the same thing, believing in Jesus and focusing on his cross, as Christians inevitably do. It is the picture of Christ and him crucified. Jesus and his cross. And that's the gospel. And Paul would later say, "I live by faith in the Son of God," that's verse 40, "who loved me and gave himself for me." That's verse 54. But they don't get it. They don't get it. And to the extent that they do get it, they don't like it, all this talk of violence and of eating flesh and drinking blood. And so they say, when they get to verse 60, when many of his disciples hear this, they're saying, "This is a hard saying. Who can listen to it?" His disciples, note, obviously a large crowd of them, in a sort of broader sense, people who claimed to be his followers. But when they hear him talk like this, they don't like it. Who can listen to it? And Jesus can tell what they're thinking. Verse 61, knowing in himself that the disciples were grumbling about this, he says, if we may paraphrase it reverently, "You think this is difficult, you ain't seen nothing yet." Verse 62, do you take offense at this? "Then what if you were to see the Son of Man ascending to where he was before?" There is much more yet to come. If you find this hard, there is more yet to come. And it becomes altogether too much. So by verse 66, we read that after this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. They'd had some interest to begin with, but they just cannot take what he says about himself and about his cross, which is to come, and about their tremendous need of him. And so they melt away one by one and disappear. Who does he think he is? And what nonsense he talks. We really can't take this at all. And off they go. And 2,000 years later, nothing has really changed very much. People have generally heard of Jesus, but they don't know much about him. And if and when they come across the extraordinary that he brings, they may well react. Not everybody will, as we see, but they may well react, at least initially, in a very similar way. Who does he think he is, saying that we need him, whoever we are and wherever we are in the world? People will say there's no room in our dangerous, fragmented, fragile model world for that kind of claimed absolute universal truth. It's very dangerous and we don't want it. Who does he think he is? May well take the form, in fact, of a slightly different question. Who do these Christians think they are saying these things? But the charge is really addressed at Jesus, isn't it? It's just that Christians believe him and repeat it. Who does he think he is, though? And secondly, what nonsense he talks. Again, this is likely, more likely to be directed at Christian believers rather than Jesus to begin with. Because the idea that the only way to make any sense of life in our modern world, 2015, the only way to make any sense of this life is to travel back 2,000 years and kneel at the feet of a crucified Galilean peasant, well, honestly, it's crazy. It's just ridiculous. Ridiculous, irrelevant nonsense, best left in the garbage bin so that we can get on with real life. Who does he think he is? And what a utter nonsense he talks. And those a Christian, of course, you don't react like that. You can see why people do. We certainly ought to see why people do. The things that Christians believe really are quite extraordinary and are bizarre in the extreme. We can understand, I hope you can understand, the skepticism of somebody who says, who looks at you and says, can you seriously believe, are you asking me to believe that there is somewhere a God who became a man, who walked and talked on the earth, who allowed himself to be put to death by crucifixion? Can you seriously believe then that that man, though 100% dead, went on to escape his grave and that he will one day sit in judgment on the whole human race? Can you seriously expect me to believe that sort of thing today? You have got to be joking. In Alice in Wonderland, the White Queen tells little Alice that she manages to believe 6 impossible things before breakfast every day. Well, good on her, but I bet they weren't as impossible as the Christian story. It's unbelievable, and yet people do believe it. Most of us here today believe it. People always will believe it. There will always be Christians in this world, whatever else, whatever other forces may be at work. How is it then that Christian people do so believe what is strangely, apparently impossible? It's a very fair question. It's a very good question, and Jesus himself answers it for us in verse 44. So if you've turned the page, we go back to page 1075, where he says, having said to them, don't grumble amongst yourselves, he then says, verse 44, words of enormous significance, that no one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day. No one can come to me, says Jesus, unless the Father who sent me draws him. Now that may seem very strange, even contradictory, because we know that when they ask him earlier in the chapter what they're meant to be doing in order to do the work of God, he replies, you are to believe in the one God has sent. You are to believe in me. The invitation is open. Whoever believes will never thirst. And more than once he rebukes them for their unbelief. And back in chapter 3, we learned that the real reason that people don't believe in Jesus is that they don't want to at the end of the day. It is just too uncomfortable because the darkness of the human heart is such that coming out into his searching light is altogether too big an ask. And so people don't want to do it. So unbelief is to be put aside. He challenges it and says the work of God is to believe in the one whom he has sent. He makes it very plain that there is no evading human responsibility where these things are concerned. We are called to believe in him. And yet, he also makes it plain that you cannot make yourself into a Christian. You cannot turn yourself into a true believer. Faith is not something you can just work up by your own effort, as the Queen wants Alice to do in Alice in Wonderland. It is not something you can just create. No, the ability to believe in Jesus is itself a gift. It is a gift of God. It's very plain from verse 44. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him. And the word draw there is full of meaning. It describes what God the Father most loves to do, to draw people to his Son. He loves to do it, and there is no suggestion that he will ever fail in the attempt. This drawing is what theologians have sometimes called effectual calling. God's effectual calling. He achieves what he sets out to achieve. His irresistible grace, it is sometimes called. And if we ask, how does God the Father draw someone to Jesus? Well, it's not aggressively. It's not hauling them in, not by naked force, but by the tender wooing of the lover. As they hear about Jesus and read of his words and think about his cross and his empty tomb, that the Father shines light by his Spirit into our darkened minds, he gently softens hardened hearts, he liberates frozen wills, and he enables us to do what we would never do if left to ourselves, which is to reach out to Jesus and to embrace him by faith. And if you listen to me or are a true Christian, you'll recognize this in your own experience. You'll say, yes, that makes sense. You'll marvel at the way that God has called you. Nobody has a story. No Christian has a story quite like yours. And you'll know that his hold on you is far stronger than your hold on him. And you'll be deeply thankful that it is so. The one who promises to raise you up on the last day, as Jesus repeatedly says here, is well able to keep you until that last day. Doesn't make sense otherwise, even though you couldn't keep yourself as a believer for more than 24 hours. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up on the last day. It is a most wonderful truth. And if we understood it better, we might perhaps nag people less, and we'd certainly pray for them more, for family, for friends, for neighbors who are not yet Christian. Father, my friends are so hard, so ignorant, so resistant to your truth, even though delightful in so many ways. Have mercy on them. Draw them to Jesus so that they may believe and have life in his name. See, we can't say, as we may want to, so-and-so is so nice, she's bound to become a Christian one day. Nor need we say desperately, so-and-so is so hard-hearted, he never will. It's all to do with the drawing of the Father. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and that, of course, he loves to do. We read in verse 66, near the end of the chapter, this is the point at which many of the disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. And so in verse 67, near the end, Jesus says to the 12 disciples, do you want to go away as well? And he receives Peter's wonderful reply, where else could we go? Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God. It's brilliant. He's got it. It's the moment of revelation for Peter. He understands now that there is no alternative to believing in Jesus and going with him. Every other route turns out to be a dead end. He really is the bread of life. Lord, to whom shall we go? There is nowhere else to turn except to you. To come to him is to find life, to have hunger satisfied and thirst quenched. But to turn away from him, whoever we may be, can only lead to slow starvation and withering away to nothing. I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger. Whoever believes in me shall never thirst.